This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Hi, I'm Greg Watson, and this is the show Property Matters, where we talk all things property, including renting, landlording, buying, selling, commercial leasing, commercial developments, you name it, it's here on Property Matters. Although I must admit that this week, as promised last week, I'm doing a show more on residential renting. And that's all things for landlords and tenants. It just seems to be so much news at the moment, real estate related, that we've had to split things a little. So let's have a look at what's happening in the news. And Trade Me reports an uncommon rent rise. And that's how they describe it, an uncommon rent rise. And this was actually widely reported across multiple news sites. But the one I'm reading from today was on stuff.co.nz in their business section. And they say that every region in New Zealand had higher rental asking prices in May than they did a year before. And that's what Trade Me's latest data shows. It's released its May Rental Price Index, which shows that the three largest cities had significant rent price growth and eight regions had strong double-digit increases. And five parts of the country hit new records, and that's Southland, Taranaki, Northland, Otago and the West Coast. Nigel Jeffries, the head of Trade Me Property, says it's very uncommon for us to see year-on-year rental price growth in every region, particularly at this time of year where we would expect the rental market to cool. He says suppliers simply not keeping up with demand around the country, which means landlords can continue to demand top dollar for their rentals. Also, with the new insulation rules for rental homes coming into effect on July 1st, so it's in effect now, we think landlords may be passing this cost on to tenants. So as part of the Healthy Home Schemes that is now in place, the requirements that all homes are rented. He says that the average number of inquiries jumped about 22% on last year as more tenants looked to make a move in May. And stock is battling to keep up with this growing demand, and we saw a 6.7% decrease in rental properties coming on the market in May. Manawatu's in a situation where there's certainly strong demand, and really a lot of positive migration has meant that rent supply and demand just keeps things moving upwards. So while Auckland has remained static at about $560 per week for most of the year, and Canterbury is also hovering around the $400 mark since September of last year. Even the red-hot summer rents in Wellington have cooled, falling slightly on January's high to $525 per week in May. Now, economist Brad Olson of Inframetrics also said it was possible. He agrees that the insulation requirements were behind the rent rises, but he does say that there are a few other areas that will be pushing up rental asking prices aside from just insulation. So he talks about other factors like the ban on property letting fees, of course, which was recently legislated, which will see landlords increasing rental costs to cover the letting fee that landlords now have to pay. There's the Healthy Home Standards, which is a series of changes that will be required to rental properties to get them up to a healthier standard of living. So landlords are looking at needing to install things and maintain ventilation fans, heat sources, moisture barriers, but there's also just the simple supply and demand, as there is not enough houses to house people, it would seem, in many locations. He says there are still spots around the country where house prices continue to increase, Manawatu, Whanganui, definitely one of them, and the rental housing stocks aren't increasing at the same price that demand has risen, putting prices up. And I talked about that last week, how areas like ours, we're way down in the number of properties available to buy. But as well as that, the same applies for properties to rent. There's not that many available, so therefore the prices are going up. Falling interest rates, though, hopefully have taken some of the pressure off landlords, and that they, some may prefer to try and keep the prices down a bit. In international news, notorious B.I.G.'s home in Brooklyn, New York, is up for rent. So this is the home that was once notorious B.I.G., that's Biggie Smalls, otherwise known as Christopher Wallace. So rap fans, here's your chance to live at large like rap legend Biggie Smalls. And that's his one-time Brooklyn, New York home is on the rental market. So this is on the Stuff lifestyle section, who quotes NME magazine / website. So the three-bedroom apartment that he used to live in is currently on offer for $4,000 US a month. It's about $6,000 New Zealand. And it's where he lived before his rise to fame. So it's actually a sleek family home with one bathroom, a study, kitchen, dining, and access to a common roof area and bike room. The walk-up apartment comes fully furnished and is just one block away from the subway and close to shops and restaurants. Now, of course, for those who don't know, Biggie Smalls or Christopher Wallace was murdered in Los Angeles in 1997, and it's a little unclear when he last lived at this house. But where it was originally, it's now one of the most coveted spots in the Big Apple, beloved by hipsters and millennials, as the New York Post notes. And during a period when Wallace lived there in the apartment, it was pretty much a no-go zone, considered to be a drug-plagued section of Clinton Hill. But fast forward to 2019 and everything's been transformed. So the home's got some of the original features. It's worth about $1.2 million New Zealand dollars. So if you wanted to rent that out and see yourself as the next Biggie Small, then that's an option for you. Here's an article from Stuff Business, and it's entitled "The Property Manager's Email Slip to Tenant in Carpet Cleaning Argument." So it's interesting because a man called Philip Ireland, rented a property in Waikanae in August with his then partner, and the tenancy was guaranteed by her father, but the couple split in November. So initially, Ireland and his partner thought he would move out and she would remain, but instead she shifted out. So Ireland claims he was then forced, in inverted commas, by the property manager called Property Scouts Greater Wellington to sign a letter requesting an end of the $530 a week tenancy. He took his case to the tenancy tribunal seeking to overturn that and enforce the tenancy agreement, but his application was dismissed. So Philip Ireland says he was told to apply to take on the tenancy in his own name, but did not. Two other people he planned to rent with did so. He said he opted not to because he was worried about that the property managers had accessed his credit file and seen a default from 2016, and has since applied for a rehearing on getting the tenancy overturned in terms of the application. So this is where things get interesting. So Property Scouts, the owner of the property, said they would rather have a family renting the house and they were not happy with reports of noise, drunkenness and disorderly behaviour from Ireland and his flatmates. We want to have it available for a family to live in. It's perfect for children with a school just around the corner. Now, this was an email, but the email went to the wrong recipient. It went to Ireland, the tenant, and since then he's complained about that request to the Human Rights Commission. He also moved out this month anyway and refused to pay for professional carpet cleaning. So, meaning to email someone else in the office, the property manager instead had emailed Ireland saying, "This guy is a first class," and it's a word starting with W and rhyming with banker. "Do I just ignore him now, have the carpet professionally cleaned and head to the tribunal to claim the bond?" In a written statement, Property Scout said the email was not meant for Ireland and he'd been very difficult to deal with. Ireland had been required to professionally clean the carpet because he'd been allowed a dog. So he was dealt with more than fairly, the property managers said. But Bindi Norwell, the chief executive at the Real Estate Institute, said it could be a problem when one tenant wanted to leave a property and another did not. "Tenants need to understand this well before they sign a legally binding contract," she said. Now, for those of you who are unsure about what she's referring to, if one tenant in a tenancy agreement gives notice, it's has the same power as if all tenants have given notice. So a landlord can, even if one of the tenants gives notice, choose to end that tenancy, and that seems to be what happened in this case. So Bindi Norwell, the CEO, says our advice to tenants is to advise their landlord and or property manager of any change in their situation. In some instances, the landlord may agree to release one party from the agreement and agree to the other party staying, so long as there have not been any problems. However, it's not guaranteed and it's not required. So this can also be a problem when a group sign an agreement and one of them does not pay the rent or willfully damages the properties and the others can be held liable. It's another quirk of tenancy law. So we appreciate that difficult and stressful circumstances such as relationship breakups can and do happen. However, it's important to note that signing a rental agreement is enforceable by law, which means it's imperative tenants understand what signing agreement with another person means. So Philip Island wanted to remain in the house after his ex moved out. His property managers didn't agree, and quite rightfully they could end that tenancy. We'll see how that one goes in court. Here's another interesting story, and this one from New Zealand Herald. Christchurch tenant left air rifle in vacated rental property and then claimed the landlord stole it. So this is in the file of just when you thought you'd heard everything. So a Christchurch tenant who left behind an air rifle in his vacated rental later, sent armed police swarming on his landlord's property by reporting the firearm stolen. So according to a recent tenancy tribunal decision, the incident started 2 days after the Christchurch mosque shootings. It's important to realise that in the context of what happens next. Now, when Jackson Donald moved out of his New Brighton rental and was found to have damaged its walls, kitchen, bench, mattress and microwave, but he also left behind an unlicensed air rifle under the bed. The landlord, Alan Butcher, found the rifle 2 weeks later and called the police and handed it over to them before telling Donald what he'd done. Donald being the tenant, or ex-tenant, that led Donald to phone police and claim Butcher had stolen his firearm, a call that sent armed police swarming to Butcher, the landlord's premises. However, in the tenancy tribunal ruling, the Christchurch tenant was found to have acted unlawfully by keeping an unlicensed air rifle in his home. Faced with armed officers at his house, Butcher was forced to explain what had happened, and the police eventually confirmed that they already had the rifle in custody. But imagine that, having the police swarm your property. It was a big shock for the landlord, Mr. Butcher, to find the air rifle, and then he had to deal with the police twice over it, the tenancy tribunal adjudicated said. The second time armed police came to the premises was at a time of extremely heightened tension over the possession of firearms, and the adjudicator found Donald, the tenant, showed a disregard for the difficult situation he put his former landlord in. In fact, of course, he'd done it intentionally. He also found Donald had committed an unlawful act by keeping an unlicensed firearm in the house and awarded $300 in exemplary damages to Butcher. The adjudicator said it's obviously behaviour that the tribunal should discourage because it's not in anyone's interests. Donald had to pay a further $541 to cover repairs for cleaning needed at the tenancy after he vacated. So I'd certainly not suggest that tenants call the police on the landlords, as it may not end well. I'll tell you about another story that didn't end well for a landlord after this break. But first of all, we'll head to some music. And for you today, we've got the Mutton Birds with Dominion Road.
Road is bending rise up 10,000 feet above the clouds, halfway down Dominion Road. Whoa. Whoa. Whoa.
And you're back with Property Matters. This is Greg Watson. We were talking before the break, of course, that song Mud and Birds, Dominion Road. We were talking before the break about strange things that tenants do and strange things that landlords do. And here's another headline from the New Zealand Herald just very recently saying, tenants damage rental with hot coals, dog ruled at fault. So we had the situation where Dunedin tenants who dropped hot coals on their carpet managed to avoid paying damages in a separate case because they claimed they tripped on the dog. So in Dunedin, I shouldn't really laugh about people dropping hot coals after tripping on the dog, but I've been to many court cases in my time and I've never had one like this before. I've had people setting fire to houses, but not due to the dog. So in Dunedin, the Tenancy Tribunal adjudicator gave no reasons why tenants Catelyn Mathias, Blair Falconer, Jacob Glossop, Rebecca Brennan New, Samuel Vanderbilt, and Kendall Lewis were carrying hot coals across their rental. But the six tenants admitted spilling the coals onto the carpet and damaging it. The adjudicator wrote, carrying hot coals over a carpeted area is something which could give rise to damage if the coals were dropped. However, I accept the evidence of the tenants that they had successfully carried out the manoeuvre twice previously on the same night until the person carrying the coals tripped over a dog. The landlord claimed carrying the coals over carpet was virtual certainty for something to go wrong, but the adjudicator disagreed and said the damage was unintentional and the tenants didn't have to pay. But the tenants did, however, have to pay $604 towards cleaning and removing rubbish left behind after their tenancy. So if tenants drop hot coals on the carpet, do they not have to pay? And this is to do with the Osaki ruling, which is hopefully going to be changes put into the latest version of the Residential Tenancies Act later on this year. But at the moment, tenants aren't responsible for accidental damage, according to that court ruling, which became a precedent. So therefore, because of the fact they tripped over their dog and the coals scattered on the floor was technically an accident, it falls back onto the landlord's insurance. And incredibly, the landlord can't even claim the excess back off the tenants. But that's the current legislative world we live in. Here's a case where a landlord was a bit more successful. There's a Wellington case here where a tenant, Corey Healy, that's a lady, was ordered to pay $1,570 to the landlord to fix her front door. So what happened? Well, this ruling came about after police recently arrived at her front door in the suburb of Te Aro and called for those inside to open it. The flat was unoccupied at the time, and when the police's, in quotes, repeated appeals to open the door went unanswered, they kicked it down. Inside, police found an illegal shotgun and ammunition, as well as Class C controlled drugs. The Tenancy Tribunal adjudicator said a male, known to reside at the address from time to time has been charged with offences related to the items seized. Healy, that's the female tenant, was not charged, but she admitted letting the man stay at her flat and that she was aware of the firearm, although she thought it wasn't working. The tenancy adjudicator said there was insufficient evidence to show Healy had used the flat for an unlawful purpose. However, the adjudicator still ordered Healy to pay for the door's replacement because she had permitted her friend to use the flat for an unlawful purpose. So in other words, as a tenant, you don't have to actually do an unlawful act yourself to be held accountable. You just have to permit somebody to do an unlawful act in order to be held responsible for that. And that's then there was another case actually in Northland where Angela Canuto was ordered to pay $1,943 to her landlord for a variety of cleaning and damage related matters. But here's the rub of that one. It included a payment of $40 to unblock the rental's toilet after it was found to have been clogged up with one of her children's toys. And this is actually something which can fall into a little grey area related to insurance. And often insurance policies for landlords will have the ability to have an option to pay no excess in a number of areas. One of them is to do with plumbing and drainage. So let's say this wasn't her child's toy, and because it was, she's responsible and has to pay for that. Let's say it was just that they used too much toilet paper or something like that. We suspect the tenant was using that toilet in a way that was not ideal and it became blocked. Well, then the tenant can't be held responsible for that and a landlord would have to pay. It's usually an insurance job to have that unblocked. Now, insurance companies have this, when the landlord claims on their insurance, they have to pay the excess. Let's say it's $500, the first $500 of that job. Now, insurance policies, if you have the option or you tick the option to say that there will be no excess on that, then it simply doesn't matter who blocked it. You don't have to pay the excess. And insurance policies in this country generally have a similar way of looking at things when it comes to glass. So glass breakage is very hard to prove who did it or hold anyone responsible. That's also a good one to have no excess on. There's another article here in Stuff Business by Martin de Ruyter called Meth Testing from Boom Industry to Pariahs. And Summit Property Management General Manager Stuart Henry says that about 10% of landlords are now testing their properties for meth contamination. And it wasn't long ago that Miles Stratford and was a household name in property investment circles. He was the face of Meth Solutions, one of the biggest meth testing businesses. The company would regularly put out a meth map report that struck fear into the heart of any potential house buyer. It showed the percentage of homes its testers found to be contaminated by meth in various parts of the country. And according to this article, in the last widely published map in September 2017, 43% of the houses Meth Solutions tested were, in inverted commas, contaminated, and Coromandel hit 46%. So this, coupled with stories of hundreds of thousands of dollars being slashed from the value of houses found to have contamination, and people even demolishing some buildings entirely, was really concerning stuff. But now Stratford has said he's had to lay off staff, and he's fuming at what he sees as an orchestrated campaign to take down the meth testing industry. So there was a report that came out from the Prime Minister's former chief science advisor, Peter Gluckman, which said that almost all claims the meth testing industry staked its existence on were false, and unless someone was buying a house where previous inhabitants were virtually smuggling their clan lab out the back window, testing was probably unnecessary. And after that report was published, the number of people requesting meth tests plummeted. Bindi Norwell, the chief executive of the Real Estate Institute, said agents estimated up to 30% of buyers, or 2,100 a month, used to specify a meth test as a condition. Now it's as low as 3 to 5%. Really was big money, and the cost of testing can range from a couple of hundred dollars to several thousand. At least 100 meth businesses incorporated since 2015 have been removed from the company's registers. Remember, it was an unregulated industry. So but there was two authors, Bardsley and Gluckman, wrote this report and said that the standards were out by a factor of at least 10 And in a house where meth had only been consumed, contamination would have to hit 15 micrograms per square metre before it triggered a clean-up. And this week, Carolyn McElnay, Director of the Public Health at the Ministry of Health, said it had received no notifications of poisoning due to chemical contamination of the environment, which is how a case of someone affected by living contaminated properties would be reported. She says, we've not been made aware of any cases where people have suffered adverse health effects as a result of living in properties where methamphetamine has been smoked. Exposure to meth in such properties is unlikely to have an acute effect, which may make case identification difficult. Bardley said it's not a safe drug, but she says there's no evidence that you can get sick from meth on the walls. It's not volatile, it doesn't come off the walls. Unless you're rolling around in it, licking it off the walls, if you've cleaned the areas you come into contact with, you'll be fine. She said that New Zealand was actually unusual in that there was concern about contamination from smoking, because in the United States the focus was purely on laboratories. The Tenancy Tribunal now uses the Glickman report to determine damages for landlords. Now, one thing that's interesting about that is insurance companies are often going with what their local council declares as being the important amount, and many insurance companies are still looking at the 1.5 level, a much lower level, as to when to pay out. And for that reason, for landlords, it's good to have a test done prior so that, if nothing else, you can make sure an insurance claim can be successful, because insurance companies are often using the 1.5 level instead of the 15 to determine whether the property has been damaged. So Glickman's report indicated that unless levels were very high, decontamination was not worth it. And generally it's more investor buyers that want meth tests than people wanting to live in the homes. Now, there will be guidelines, hopefully, in the Residential Tenancies Act Amendment Bill, which is currently before Parliament, and that will allow regulations to be made under the Act which would be legally binding and to clear some of this up. So at the moment, just to clarify, it's worth having a test done, in my view, due to the insurance company's cut-off being so low, and you want to make sure that if something happens to your house, you can make a successful claim. And that's my viewpoint there. Certainly when buying a property, I would still have it tested, just for peace of mind. That's all we've got time for today. This is Greg Watson. This has been Property Matters. It's been lovely having your company. Have a great week.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.